And that takes us to 8:34 in the morning. The program is Upfront. My name is Brian Edwards Tiekert.
I'm Antonia Yuhas. We're continuing our series investigating ICE with our guest joining us now in studio, Catherine Taktakin.
Close.
You say it correctly. I'm sorry.
Taktakin.
Thank you. Taktakin. She's executive director of the National Network for Immigrant and Refugee Rights. She's just returned from New York, as I mentioned earlier, where she was in meetings all week for final negotiations on the Global Compact for Migration. She's also recently published an article on the website of the National Network for Immigrant and Refugee Rights entitled, "The Problem is Bigger Than ICE." She joins us today in studio. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for inviting me.
First, can we get an update from you on the latest on child reunification and the policies at the border?
Well, as you probably know, we're still waiting for all of those children to be reunited with their families. So the latest is that the ACLU had filed a lawsuit, and the same judge who had ordered that the children be reunited agreed that there should be a waiting period for families that have been reunited to consider whether the children might actually remain in country, in the United States, if the parents are deported. As you know, when the children were separated from their families, they were actually recategorized as unaccompanied minors and treated as if they had entered the country without their parents. And so they have separate cases, essentially, from their parents. We learned that upwards of 3,000 children had actually been separated. I think there are still 2,000 who have not been reunited. And, you know, we're hearing the really tragic story that the U.S. missed the deadline to reunite the young children, those below the age of 5. Only 58 have been reunited out of over 100. And they're saying that they will not reunite a number of them because supposedly the parents, I think over a dozen parents, have already been deported. And there are others who supposedly have some criminal charges against them, and we don't know what those charges are. And since immigration, you know, crossing the border has become criminalized, we don't really know what that means. So for those children who have not been reunited, and they're saying that will not happen, we don't know. And what is really concerning is that deportations, you know, continue to happen. So there may be children who are just left here. And I think we're all still reeling from the tragedy of this. And even when children are reunited with their parents, realizing that, you know, a 3-year-old has been separated from, you know, their parents for 4 months. It's just still unbelievable.
I mean, we're starting to get now reports in detail on families that have been reunited and clear signs of enduring trauma among particularly some of those younger kids.
Oh, absolutely. The younger children and even the older ones who are realize what happened, and they're drawing the conclusion that they were abandoned. So it's not just the trauma that is indescribable for really young children who can't articulate that trauma, but for the older ones who can, I mean, it's just tragic.
And so we clearly have a broad system of policies that we need to look at, and we're far, far from reaching the goal of family reunification just in the case of these 3,000 children. And of course, there's many, many, many more thousands to be concerned about. And so putting that within to this context of looking at ICE as an institution that's enforcing many of these problematic policies. There is an Abolish ICE movement, as you know, and you wrote an article recently that is entitled "The Problem is Bigger Than ICE." Can you start by telling us why you wrote that piece?
Well, I did that because when we saw the slogan "Abolish ICE" and we saw, you know, policymakers, members of Congress begin to pick that up, we were concerned that, you know, obviously a slogan is not a strategy, and that the slogan didn't quite capture the the whole series of decades of policies that criminalize immigrants that really provide the mandate for ICE, which is the instrument to carry out this kind of community terror that we've been witnessing. And it's all embedded within the Department of Homeland Security. And the Department of Homeland Security was, you know, created supposedly to guard our national security, and it intertwined immigration policy within that context. So to dismantle ICE would be one thing, but it could, another agency enforcing the same policies could take its place. And the bigger haul really has to do with transforming the policies, which are complicated, decades long, that we have that really allow ICE to carry out these kinds of practices. So there's a lot of layers to what it means to abolish or dismantle ICE, and even for the general public, but also for policymakers, there's a question about whether, in fact, they can say we and have introduced legislation to abolish ICE, but are they also prepared to decriminalize immigration policy?
So I think we should do a little bit of unpacking here, just for the sake of institutional literacy, because the Republican attack on the abolish ICE movement is this means open borders. In fact, it's a different agency, as I understand it, Customs and Border Protection, that patrols the border and the area around it, intercepts people who've just crossed the border. ICE handles deportation proceedings inside the country. They're the ones who go pick up people at their home because of a speeding ticket they got 5 years ago that just trickled through the system now and puts green card in jeopardy.
That's right.
So the abolish ICE movement is actually a relatively narrow focus on that arm of the immigration enforcement apparatus.
Right. And, you know, as slogans go, I think it probably does capture what is also taking place at the border. I'm sure that's the intention. And when most people hear abolish ICE, they're thinking about the, you know, the agency, Border Patrol as well, and don't really understand technically, you know, the distinctions. There are actually two sub-agencies within ICE. There's one for enforcement and removals, and that's the one that we, I think, generally characterizes as ICE. And then there's the investigative arm of ICE, which also functions. But it's true, there are those two, and they work in sync. And increasingly, what we've seen is that a lot of the enforcement policies that are more oriented towards the border have been creeping inside. So, you know, the border extends 100 miles. So we're talking about enforcement even at the border that is regional in character.
You mean the jurisdiction of Customs
and
Border
Protection. Right, the jurisdiction of the Border Patrol. But it's, you know, again, they're agencies, they're instruments of policy. And unless we change some of the laws that allow ICE and CBP to conduct itself in that way, you know, we will just be replacing one bad agency with another bad agency. And that is a longer haul. So there are various strategies towards, you know, beginning to dismantle ICE that actually have to do with targeting also the policies.
Let me push back on that for 1 second. There are a bunch of former Obama officials now who are saying publicly, look, when we were worried ICE was a rogue agency. Like, our directives on immigration about how to use executive discretion were not getting implemented. Antonia just did this interview with an academic, Sue Long, who basically had the statistical breakdown saying when the official Obama policy was for ICE to only pursue and deport serious violent criminals, they were picking up people on minor offenses like speeding tickets just so they could get their statistics up. I mean, doesn't the culture and the internal politics of an agency count for something? Isn't it possible you just have an institution that's so rotten the actual policies don't matter?
Well, it is. And frankly, that applies to both ICE and the Border Patrol. Mm-hmm. So the Border Patrol has murdered, you know, how many dozens of migrants at the border on this side and the other side of the border, the Mexican side of the border, with impunity. So there is, of course, that kind of, I think, culture within the two agencies. You know, and they certainly, even during the Obama period, when they may have been having more specific targets targets for arrests and deportation. There were also collateral arrests and deportations, just as there have been under the Trump administration, when 75% of those picked up are collateral arrests. They weren't the targets, even as sweeping as they have been under Trump. So Obama did not achieve the, you know, the name of deporter in chief for nothing. You know, those, even with those targeted arrests, they were serious. And let's face it, family separations have been going on for decades, more than three decades. One of the first reports the National Network did in 1998, given a slew of immigration raids, our tagline was, immigration raids shatter families. There have been millions of families separated over the past few decades in this country. It's not just what's taking place at the border now under the Trump administration, and that's at the hands of these institutions, even before Department of Homeland Security. We're talking about INS, the Immigration and Naturalization Service.
Isn't part of the idea of focusing on abolish ICE is coming out of the sanctuary city policy? So first we're going to say our police and our institutions are not going to work in tandem with ICE. We're going to separate out our policing from ICE activities. And then the maybe a natural evolution of that is, if we're not going to partner with you, maybe you, that implies that we don't think what you're doing is something that we need to be, that we should be supporting, that it is, as an institution, it's not necessary. And could you see then abolishing ICE as an agency as a step towards the broader policies that you're talking about? And then let's talk about what these broader policies would be.
Well, obviously, more immediately, you know, if we translate abolish ICE into, you know, some, you know, just tactically, how are we going to do that? What has already been, you know, operating is a campaign to defund ICE. Similarly, that's been, you know, a charge around the Border Patrol. So we spend so much money in immigration enforcement in the interior and at the border. And certainly one way to kind of cut the legs off, you know, of those agencies is to defund them. You know, and that is a charge to Congress. And that's something that people can get involved in. So, you know, again, having a, you know, hashtag abolish ICE, doing our mass mobilizations is one thing. Another is to actually begin to tackle that and force the question in Congress and in a national debate about, you know, the continued financial support increasingly for these types of agencies, and also backed by, you know, I think the cases that you've cited, there are terrible human rights abuses, violations, fatalities at the hands of these agencies.
You write, looking back at the policies, these policies have for decades, as you've mentioned, separated families, contributed to migrant deaths at the border, and have heightened a racist, hate-filled, and divisive narrative now led by no less than the White House. What are the policies that need to change? If the broader problem is the criminalization of immigration, how do we need to take a broader look at this problem?
Well, the policies, you know, even prior to 9/11, we set in motion policies that essentially criminalized undocumented migration. We're mainly talking about undocumented migration. And frankly, that begins, I mean, 1986, IRCA, the Immigration Reform and Control Act, is still the standard of our immigration policy. That was the last major immigration reform bill to have passed in Congress. And it essentially criminalized undocumented workers through employer sanctions. We have IRERA, the Illegal Immigrant Responsibility and Reform Act in 1996, which was applied retroactively, which transformed misdemeanors into criminal charges and has been responsible, largely responsible for a massive increase in arrests, detentions, and deportations. That was in 1996. Mm-hmm. And then we have 9/11, post-9/11, and just the heightening of laws that criminalized migrants. We have Operation Streamline at the border, which is responsible for the mass, you know, prosecution of border crossers. We criminalized border crossing. It's no longer an administrative violation. It used to be an administrative violation handled in immigration courts. There are two provisions now in criminal code that make illegal entry and re-entry felonies. And that's what's being used by Sessions, for example.
That's the legal basis for the zero-tolerance
policy. Yeah, but it's a whole, you know, these laws are all connected. And then you have it backed by the kind of ugly rhetoric that we've seen. So, you know, even if Trump had not said what he has been saying, we have a body of laws that has clearly gone in the direction of criminalizing immigrants. 50% of those entering federal prison today are immigrants, not because immigrants are just so-called bad people. They're there due to the criminalization of immigration law.
So I think, like, it's become such a mainstay of American political discourse that the problem with immigration is the breaking of laws. Right, the undocumented status. I think it's worth maybe you stepping back for a minute and painting a picture of what the system would look like if the things you just outlined were not criminalized.
Well, I think in another period when immigration violations were treated as administrative, and frankly, you mentioned that I was just in New York on the Global Compact for Migration. This was something that civil society was advocating for, that the decriminalization of immigration violations. And frankly, it's not just the U.S. There are other countries that look at undocumented border crossing as criminal activity. We were not successful in getting blanket language which looked at those violations as administrative and not subject to detention. Mm-hmm. That was key. As long as those are treated as criminal violations, detention can be a consequence. If certainly we would prefer to see those kinds of violations being here without status.
But if not detention,
as something that's administrative. We used to have a dozen ways in which someone who is undocumented or who fell into an undocumented status could adjust their status. We no longer have those. All of those have been taken away. So we've also created a situation, a condition in which there's very little recourse if you're in the country without status to be able to successfully adjust status. And we've steadily decreased the ability for people to enter with visas, which of course people would prefer to do. They would prefer safe passage with a visa.
And just to get totally clear on it, if criminalization is taken away and then detention is taken away as a response, what then is the remedy to people crossing the border without permission or being in the United States without permission? You talked about ways to normalize their status. What's the worst sanction in a decriminalized context? Deportation?
Well, if as we've had on the border now, and as you know, border crossings have steadily decreased. Those that we see now coming across, first of all, they're not largely from Mexico. That's been a change. They are coming from Central America, right, and they are asylum seekers. Or we've had the thousands who came, for example, from Haiti, within a couple of years ago. Certainly, you know, we need to have a program in which everyone has an individual right to state a case if they come to the border and seek entry, if they're seeking asylum, to have that case treated separately, individually, and seriously. Certainly, we need to revise our immigration policies generally to provide better access to visas, to entry. So, as you know, we still have a huge backlog of family-based petitions for people to enter the country based on family unity. As you know, Trump wants to, they want to remove two of the avenues for family-based immigration and slash family-based immigration in half. Yet the conditions which, whether it's family unity or people feeling that they are fleeing prosecution, we're cutting those avenues away from access to cross in, you know, in a legal or in a regular fashion. So there's a number of things which could be taken. And certainly if someone is, you know, has crossed, say they're here, there's a violation again, looking at all the avenues for someone to possibly remain. That might mean close family ties, for example. A lot of people who are crossing have family ties. A lot of people who have crossed and recrossed once they've been deported is because they have families here that they're supporting. So all of those things could be taken into consideration if we're looking at individuals, if we're looking at units of, we're looking at human beings and not blanketly prosecuting criminally everyone who attempts to cross the border.
We're speaking to Kathy Tuck-Tonkin. She is with the National Network of Immigrant and Refugee Rights.
Kathy, can you talk a little bit more about what took place in New York and coming from the Global Compact for Migration? I want to put these Trump policies in particular into a national context. We have, as you said, we have a long history of abusive policy towards immigrants and the criminalization of immigration, but we have a particularly abusive administration now trying to do its best to shut down borders. Please put this into the global context for us.
Sure. Well, the Global Compact came out of a process over the last few years, actually, within the United Nations to address the whole phenomena of large movements of forced migration, and realizing that actually our international laws, whether we're looking at refugee law or global migration policies, aren't really in sync with the phenomena, and to address that. So there were actually two processes, one to develop a compact for refugees and one for migration, and we were involved in the one on migration. The Trump administration withdrew in the middle of this process. It was an 18-month process. In December, they withdrew from the process before negotiations began. We just went through 6 months of monthly negotiations in the UN. So civil society, we had a voice. We didn't have a vote. We were grateful to have quite a bit of access to the process itself with the co-facilitators, ambassadors from Switzerland and Mexico, and access to the government delegations as well. So we certainly didn't get everything that we wanted. We wanted, we were hopeful that the compact would address this question of non-criminalization, for example, of irregular migration. We wanted a greater commitment towards services for regular and irregular migrants, so migrants regardless of status, a greater commitment to workers' rights, again, regardless of status. So we got, you know, there was some very positive language. As we say, this is a transitional document, but not a transformational one. But the process itself, without the United States, was actually was fairly good. It was one of the first times that human rights was really front and central as a framework on global migration, and not one that was characterized by migration and development, for example, or migration for development. Mm-hmm. So it put a lot of very controversial questions on the table. I think if the U.S. had been present, it would have been a different conversation. As it was, we heard, you know, Hungary will probably not support this, even though it's a non-binding document. This is non-binding. It's not a convention. It's not a treaty. And there may be some other countries, but we were surprised that even the EU, which pushed back on a lot of things, was fairly gracious in its reporting on the final document.
Well, I mean, I would say if there's a government that the Trump administration may be modeling itself on the issue of migration, the Orbán government of Hungary may be at one of the most restrictive in the world,
right,
and most aggressive in the world in attacking migrants.
And we're going to have to leave it there. Kathy Tuck-Tonkin, thank you so much for coming in.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for joining us.
Kathy Tuck-Tonkin is Executive Director of the National Network for Immigration and Refugee Rights.